Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. My name is Jamie. We got some great movie discussion a little bit later on in the show, but first, let's get to our featured interview. Farewell tells the amazing true story of a KGB colonel in 1981 who collaborated with a French engineer in what became the most important Cold War espionage operation known to date. So important, in fact, that it was instrumental in leading to the end of the Cold War. The film is the work of writer-director Christian Carrion, who earned an Oscar nomination for his second film, Merry Christmas, in 2006. The film opens in New York and L.A. on July 23rd, and here Christian discusses his cinematic influences, what drew him to the Farewell Affair, and the difficulties he endured in bringing his vision to the screen. If I read correctly, you had kind of a different career track in mind than becoming a filmmaker. So I'm wondering when films became a passion for you and when you decided you wanted to follow this as your life's journey.
Yeah. Because my parents were farmers and they want me to be an engineer because it was a kind of revenge to not the exciting life they were living. I love my parents, so I try to do my best to be the engineer they want me to be. But I did it, and I never boring, but it was not my passion.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was 35, 36, after 15 years of my career of engineer, I was working for water. But when I was 35, 36, I tried to make my first movie, and by chance, it had been a big success, and I was allowed to make another one.
Mm-hmm. When you were discovering your passion for films, were there particular films or filmmakers that you gravitated towards more than others?
It was an old passion because I can't say I have a dream, a very naive dream of cinema when I was 13, 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were from it, but they loved cinema, so we used to go to watch movies on theaters, and it's difficult to tell you exactly which movie has been the very start, but I know, because I didn't make any school of cinema, my only school was theater, watching
mm-hmm.
movies. And Hitchcock and John Ford are the two very first masters for me.
Yeah.
Because with Hitchcock, I learned the grammar to make movies. And with John Ford, I learned kind of humanity, how to shoot spaces. And so on, which is very important for me. That's why there is the man who shot Liberty Valance in Farewell, because it's my homage to John Ford.
Well, I noticed that too, and it's interesting that you point out Hitchcock, because this film, I think, combines the Hitchcock and the John Ford styles beautifully, because it's a very effective thriller. Farewell is, but at the same time, it never loses sight of the humanity in the characters. So another thing I wanted to ask about you starting as a filmmaker? I mean, you have several films under your belt now. Can you look back and see what your particular voice is as a filmmaker and what kinds of stories you tend to be drawn to?
Oh, well, my God, I don't try to listen to... I don't try to see which mark or which voice I try to put in my work. I'm very, very instinctive, to be honest with you. So my first instinct is, yes, the humanity, the emotion I can feel as a human being in each story. For Merry Christmas, my previous movie, I was very, very, very moved to know they did it. I mean, A Christmas Truce in 1914, and I tried to do my best to recreate the emotion of that time.
Mm-hmm.
For Farewell, I was very touched by the destiny of this guy who can say at the beginning, I can change the world, and everybody is laughing, and at the end, something changed.
Yeah.
And he did it with a very lonely, very sadly, you know, a lot of problems with his wife, his mistress, his son, with everybody, but he tried to do something and he succeeded to change something. Not in the way he expected, but at the end, yes, something changed.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that kind of story. You know, story where the people, I mean, yes, the character tried to change something. My first movie was The Girl from Paris, the story of a woman who decided to change her life totally, and she tried to do something, which is very complicated, difficult for her, but she tried to do something. Christmas, Merry Christmas, they tried to do something, you know, which was impossible to imagine, and Farewell, it's the same story, you know, someone said, let's change something.
And I'm curious, I read the beginnings of this project. It was going to be an American production, and that fell through. So how did you become involved at that point?
The first writer, he's French, and he wanted to make the movie, to direct the movie in the U.S., like a studio movie, you know, all in English and so on. But for many reasons I don't really know, it failed. So he came back in Europe, in London, and tried to make the movie in an English language.
Right.
But the producer in London knew my producer, French producer. They talked about the project, and at the end they proposed it to me. And I said to them, okay, I'm very excited by the project, the guy, Farewell. But I want to respect the three languages, I mean Russian, French, and English. For many reasons. First of all, because I can't imagine François Mitterrand speaking in English. it's a pure fantasy. No French president can speak in English. And the Russians, they speak Russian. They don't even know. Well, they know they are foreign language, but they are very proud of Russian language, so they don't speak. They only speak Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And so on and so on. It makes sense to respect the three languages. It's much more complicated because I don't speak Russian. And I try to do my best to speak in English, but I think we have to make an effort to be closer to the reality of this story by respecting the three languages. And my producer respect my wish, especially because we made Joyeux Noël, Merry Christmas before in three languages too.
Mm-hmm.
And it was easier for us to impose a movie in three languages in French. Because of Merry Christmas.
Well, when you set out and you wrote your, you began to write your screenplay for Farewell, did you reference, I don't know if you do this in general when you prepare a movie, do you reference any other films, in the case of Farewell, possibly other political thrillers?
First of all, There was one difficulty is we don't do political movie in France.
Right.
Well, we don't do anymore. We used to do during the 70s, but since that time, I must confess, we don't do it anymore, and I regret it very much. That's why I love American movies, because they dare. They really dare to do it. And for example, I asked to my crew to watch a movie before the start of the preparation, an American movie named All the President's Men.
Oh.
You remember?
Yes.
Jan Pakula from Jan.
One of my favorites. Alan Pakula,
oh,
yeah,
great.
One of my favorites. Mm.
Yeah. Robert Redford, produced by Robert Redford and
mm-hmm.
Dustin Hoffman in 1976. So, a couple of years after Watergate.
Right.
And this is the big power of your cinema. You are able to make a movie quickly after the real story. In France, well, it's difficult. We don't have real movies about, for example, Algerian War or something like this. You know, it's very difficult. So, yes, this movie, All the Men's President, I imposed to my crew because I said to them, you will see a movie where in which nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
Just two guys talking to each other, and at the end, the president has to leave. That's why I love.
Well,
because
yeah,
I knew that in Farewell, there will no car crash, no James Bond girl, no gun, just two guys talking in their cars.
Right, and it's thrilling. It's an amazingly structured film. I'm curious though, since you brought up the French cinema and their reluctance to deal with political themes head on. Why is that?
Oh, for many reasons. First one, an economic reason. We, a French cinema, we depend too much from the TV, from the money coming from the TV.
Mm-hmm.
We have a system in which we impose to the French channel to put a lot of money in the movies. They have to because it's the law. And of course they do it. But they try to have good movies for them. I mean, the length, not too much. It's very difficult to produce a movie longer than 2 hours because TV said no. Channel, they say no, it's too long for us.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible to make a movie in black and white and so on and so on. So the channel, they impose their way of making movies. And second, they don't want any political movies because they don't want any problem with the government.
Right.
It's not a censure. It's auto-censure, I mean. They censure themselves.
Right.
Which
right.
is worse. The worst censure. Because you can't say, this is the guy who's saying no. Everybody is saying no. So that's why it's difficult to make political projects. And second, our generation is less excited, less involved in historical project, political project, and I don't feel alone, but I can see it's very specific the way I want to make my movies because, well, it's not the way they want to make their own projects.
Right. Did you find because of that connection with French cinema, and I understand that the Russians were reluctant to become involved in this project. I mean, is that correct? Did you find that this was a difficult film to get going?
Oh yeah, yeah. I was really now I understand. I was really naive.
Right.
Because at the beginning, I was like in Merry Christmas. For Merry Christmas, I went to Germany, I went to Scotland, and I say to them, I have to tell the story with you because your country was involved in the true story. And they did it. And for Farewell, I went to Moscow. I met Nikita Mikhalkov, you know who he is,
mm-hmm.
and I said to him, I need you to help me to tell the story to your people. Russian people. And he was really enthusiastic at the beginning. he wanted to be co-producer, a Russian co-producer. And he helped me to find a good Russian actor. I found one, Sergei Makovetsky, an amazing actor. He went to Paris, so we start to the preparation of a movie. And 6 weeks before the start of the movie, the Russian ambassador in Paris called the actor on his cell phone and he said, Sergei, you're an amazing actor and the Russian people, they love you. But the Russian people will never, never understand why he decided to make a French movie and to defend a traitor, a bullshit.
Huh.
Think about your career. And he went back to Moscow and called me and he said, okay, forget my number, forget my name, I don't do anything with you.
Oh, wow.
So I called back Nikita and I said to Nikita, well, an ambassador calling an actor, maybe in North Korea I can understand, but you told me about a new Russia. This is new. This is not a new Russia. This is the same fucking Russia.
Uh-huh.
And he said, no, I can't believe it. I know the Russian ambassador in Paris. He's a very good friend of mine because when I make Putin's birthday, we are 10 at home and he's with us. I'm going to call him and I call you back. Call me back 4 days after, which is not a good news, and told me, forget everything because the Russian ambassador first will be the Russian minister of culture and you will never have any Russian actor able to make your movie.
Hmm.
And myself, I don't co-produce anymore your movie because you will not have any authorization to shoot in Moscow. So I will be useless.
Wow.
And at the end, so we shot in Ukraine and Finland. And I proposed to my producer to work with an actor able to speak Russian but not Russian. This is how the idea of Emir Kusturica arrives.
Mm-hmm.
And now I would like to thank the Russian Minister of Culture, because without him, Emir would not be in this movie, and I know what Emir brings to the movie.
Absolutely. But your two lead characters, and I know you've been asked this a lot, are themselves accomplished directors, and I'm wondering what that's like to direct someone who is so adept at directing themselves.
You have to forget their movies first. Because especially Emir has two Palme d'Or in the French Festival of Cannes, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
He's very famous, and in Guillaume too. So forget their movies, but you know, they are just actors on the set. They don't try, you know, to give you any... I don't ask any question about your mise-en-scène and so on, you know. Never.
Yeah.
It's a, how can I say, a political agreement between directors. And, you know, director, he knows very well how difficult it is to make a movie. So
mm-hmm.
He's just sitting on his chair waiting for his time to play. That's all.
When you're dealing with a true story like this, how concerned are you with staying true to the facts, and does that ever clash with what you need to do to make it work as a movie?
You're right. I'm not. Fair One is not a documentary, first,
mm-hmm.
and it's not because it's impossible to make a true documentary because we know a lot of things. But there are a lot of things we will never know, I'm sure. Sure.
Right.
And till now, some people think differently about Farewell. Some French people think they are not Farewell Affair. There is not Farewell Affair. There is just a guy working for the CIA, and the CIA asked him to give information to the French to test the loyalty of François Mitterrand to the U.S. You understand what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't believe in this idea, but just to tell you, it's difficult to know exactly what happened. So I say to myself, okay, it's not a documentary. I try to do my best to give all the information I have, all what I think, my personal opinion, And if the movie works, the people, they will be interested and they try by themselves to know much more about Farewell to Fame. They will
yes.
be interested, excited, which is only my aim, you know, to interest you, to catch you, and then after, you will try to know and you will find by yourself how difficult it is to know exactly what happened.
Right.
So I just try to open the door, you don't know, and behind the door, it's up to you to find what it is.
I think that's the, I love that you said that, because I think that's the power of great cinema, especially a film that deals with international themes and political themes. You mentioned All the President's Men. That film and JFK, they both inspired me to learn more and question
exactly.
things for myself. And so I think
yeah.
that's beautiful that you've made a film that will do the same thing.
Oh, thank you so much. It's the best compliment I would dream to have, because it's exactly the spirit in which I am. I don't want to tell you a truth. I just give you a key. It opens the door, and then do it by yourself.
Well, before I let you go, let me ask you about how people have responded to your film. I know you've screened it all over. What has that response been from audiences?
Well, we make in France, the release start was in September the previous year, and because of a movie, a lot of books, a lot of documentaries, you know, newspaper about Farewell everywhere. It was my my reward, in sort of way, because everybody trying to know exactly what happened. A lot of people I never met before have an opinion about Farewell. Okay, good, I'm happy. They were talking about Farewell like never before.
Yeah.
This is the strength of cinema. It's a popular art. I mean, it touches a lot of people when it works. And when you can do that, I can tell you feel better.
Yeah. You've done your job.
Because I say, okay, now they want to know. Okay, that's all. And they will try to know by themselves. So, yes, a lot of books and so on. We have a good response from the audience in France. And now we start abroad. Especially, I was really waiting for the U.S. Release because of the story. Because I knew that no one knows the story here in USA. And I think you have to know it, because, first of all, your country was very deeply involved. And second, because this story concerned everybody now after the fall of the war.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Will it ever will it show in Russia?
Forget it. Never. Never, never, yeah. Because, as I told you, there is a minister of culture who hates the story of Farewell. By the way, we discover he was in Paris in 1983. Like, he was working in the Russian USSR embassy. And he has been expelled with 47 other diplomats by François Mitterrand because of Farewell. Isn't funny, you know, 25 years after, I discover the story is not dead.
Well, and it goes to show that he understands in a different way the power of the cinema too, because he knows that when his people see a film like
right.
this, they will question.
No question in Russia, because no release, never.
Do you have anything upcoming that you've already planned? Is there something on the horizon for you?
No, I just, I'm going to Boston tomorrow to make the opening of a French Film Festival in Boston, and there will be a Q&A, and I'm very excited by American Q&A. I want to talk with the American people about that story, you know, I start with Toronto, with other and in LA and so on, and it's very, very exciting for me to talk with the American people because of his story.
Okay, that is director Christian Carrion. The movie is called Farewell. It opens July 23rd in New York and L.A. We are just waiting for our fellow movie geek, Chris, to call in, and the movie discussion will continue. Let me just let you guys know that we have a great series of shows coming up throughout the month, and I'm in the process of trying to bring them up now so I can remember the dates that they air. But this coming Sunday, we have a very fascinating documentary with a director by the name of Alan G. Parker, who has done a new documentary on Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen. If you recall, the case is about 30 years old now, over 30 years, where Sid Vicious was just assumed to be the murderer of his girlfriend, Nancy Spungen. And Mr. Parker has made it kind of a 24-year journey investigating the case, and he's produced a documentary that proves that, I think proves beyond a doubt, that Sid Vicious could not have committed that crime. Here's a quick trailer to the film. Again, this interview will air on Sunday night, and then we'll bring on Chris for some movie talk.
Him there, and on the bathroom floor they found the 20-year-old American girl he'd lived with for 2 years. Sid Vicious was arraigned today on charges of murder.
This is like right out of a Twilight Zone episode. You wake up, there's a knife, a pool of blood, and your girlfriend's in the bathroom, stabbed to death.
This guy's name was Vicious, supposedly violent. You know, of course he killed his girlfriend.
About 12 o'clock, Sid Vicious shot up some heroin. About 2 o'clock, he laid down to go to sleep.
Sid is no longer vicious, he's dead.
Nobody ever followed up on it. It's like Sid got out, Sid OD'd, end of story. Is that really what happened?
There were so many people in the Chelsea, in that room that night. None of these people seemed to have told anyone their story.
Detective Kilroy was one of the arresting officers when Sid was arrested. As far as he was concerned, Sid had guilty man written all over him. It was a smoking gun case.
People who'd been at the party saw her flashing a lot of money around. No money was found in the room.
The last magazine interview the pair of them did, they were already telling people they'd got a suicide pact.
What would you like to happen now? I'd like to have fun. Are you having fun at the moment?
No, I'm not having fun at all.
Where would you like to be?
Under the ground.
The police all treated this like, who cares? Just another dead junkie.
He was a guy that never saw a red light. Everything was always green.
However dangerous.
However dangerous.
Who killed Nancy?
Nancy killed Nancy.
Fame killed Nancy Spungen.
It was Varkens Red Glare.
Obviously not Sid.
I think he did it in a moment of madness.
Oh my God, I know he didn't. She goes, that Michael guy was crazy.
This is the guy life would do it.
Sid was so stoned, he could not have lifted that knife, much less stabbed somebody with it.
And Beverly said to me, do me a favor and make sure that one day the world knows that whatever else my son was, he was not a murderer.
It's a fascinating movie, and we will have the director on Sunday night. Chris, you're on, dude.
Yo.
Yo. Just the two of us, baby.
Just the two of us.
Oh, I should have downloaded that. That would have been good theme music.
Yeah.
For us. You're at the beach, man. You got vacation week.
Yeah, I'm chilling right now. So if my connection is no good or if my call gets dropped, it's not my fault. I'm on the Gulf Coast of Florida on an island. So
yeah, really it does sound a little oily, your connection.
Okay.
Do you see any of that on the beach or anywhere?
No.
Okay.
No, it has not made its way here yet. No.
Because I know it's in Destin, actually, in Florida. It's being washed up on the beach,
It doubtlessly will eventually be here. Certainly in a year's time, it'll be here, probably before that. Enjoying it while I can, I'm sure, you know, we forget, like, some people are like, oh, I probably won't make it this far. Like, it's not even contained yet. It's still gushing into the ocean, and you're making proclamations that it will not make it to certain places. It could be in Australia, for all we know. So, yeah, it'll be here.
Well, yeah, but we have Kevin Costner. He's come through. Actually, he has in a big way. Have you heard that? I mean, this is movie related. They've purchased 32 of the machines that he invested in.
Well, they're clutching at straws now. I mean, it's literally trying anything. sort of clean it up.
And actually, the oil spill is the greatest disaster to happen to water since Waterworld. So it's ironic. Thank you. So your reception sounds great. I think every time you call in, you should be at the beach.
Fantastic. I think so, too.
We talked about something last week. You weren't here for that, but it's ironic because last Wednesday night we started talking about career rebirth, the likelihood that somebody like, say, a Mel Gibson could get over his bad press and continue to have a flourishing career. The next day, the new bombshells about Mel Gibson came out with these tapes and domestic abuse and more racial slurs and everything. He's over now, isn't he, do you think?
Somehow a lot of this has, like, flown under people's radar. Like, I'm with my family at the beach, and I mentioned it, and no one seemed to have heard about it. And I don't know. I don't know. I think that people sort of expect, like, we're just sort of like, eh, yeah, we knew he was a racist. Like, oh, you know, a guy that hates the Jews. Oh, shocking. He also hates black people. I'm glad I was sitting down when I read that, you know.
This is more damaging because the accusation is, and there's a second tape that apparently proves it, that he punched her in the face twice when she was holding their baby.
That's something
that's a little unforgivable, don't you think?
Yeah. If that's the truth, and I had not heard that, but if that's the truth, then yeah, I think unfortunately, he is he's got to be done for. No one's going to want to touch him with a 10-foot pole. I think he becomes a pariah even in Hollywood. I mean, I don't know. He already was a pariah in Hollywood. If a combination tape where not only are you punching your wife who's holding your baby, and you also say you hope she gets raped by a pack of N-words. That's pretty damning on top of anti-Semitic.
Yeah, a little damning.
Anti-Semitic comments like, I don't know. I feel like we don't care if you're in the next Mad Max movie after that. I certainly don't. I mean, I like Mel Gibson, but I feel like the man has psychologically, there's definitely something going on there. That's not the kind of person we should be glorifying in any way. And I never buy into that kind of stuff. I really feel like people's personal lives, I'm usually, you know, I'm a Woody Allen fan, a Roman Polanski fan. I can hold those things separate. And what those guys, certainly what Roman Polanski did is much, much worse than anything Mel Gibson has done. But when someone shows a trend like Mel Gibson has of just making really poor decisions and just not even poor decisions, just having a bad mental, a bad mindset about things. I don't care anymore. And if the best you're going to do is Edge of Darkness and Apocalypto, two solid, you know, sevens,
right.
I think we can do without.
Well, this being a movie show, I mean, we obviously bring it up because what is his bankability or accessibility to audiences in the future? Plus, I feel bad for Jodie Foster because Jodie Foster has the movie that she directed and she recruited Mel Gibson for her lead, The Beaver, about this kind of mentally deranged guy that he carries on conversations with a beaver puppet he carries around. And they said that this could be Mel Gibson's shot at acting credibility again, where he comes back to the forefront of possibly being award nominated and all that kind of stuff. Now that September release, I what do you do with it? Do you capitalize on the controversy and release it? Do you push it back? What?
I think you do capitalize on it. The weird thing is, I think we've talked about this before, look at Charlie Sheen. I mean, Charlie Sheen's career, I mean, he's had a long, rich history of making awful comments about things, and even worse than that, it's the whole thing with the prostitutes and Heidi Fleiss, and then this most recent stuff where he apparently threatened to kill his wife with a knife, and he remains the highest paid actor on television in a silly, you know, situational comedy. And people don't seem to care. Like, people seem to keep forgiving Charlie Sheen over and over again. So I think somehow there is a way to spin this sort of stuff, even as bad as Mel Gibson's thing is.
She ran into his fist?
Yeah, she ran into his fist, yeah. I don't know what that is. I'm not excusing it. I'm just saying, look at Charlie Sheen. Charlie Sheen has arguably done as bad a thing as Mel Gibson has, and it slid right off his back.
Yeah.
He didn't have to go make some daring turn as, you know, a psychologically disturbed man. You know, I mean, he's on the dumbest
mm-hmm.
show on TV.
So. yes, he is. You know, I think Mel Gibson, obviously a very charismatic actor. I think he's a stunning director. I mean, even if I have been lukewarm. I was lukewarm on Apocalypto, but I saw it as a real achievement in
yeah.
terms of its ambition, in terms of its visual splendor, and I feel the same way about Passion of the Christ. I always loved Braveheart, and it had a lot of those same strengths too.
Well,
and then
all
he
three
wants,
of those movies are like crackling; like they all have a
yeah.
sort of a crackling sensation to them. They're never dull. They're never boring for even a moment.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they're alive. So I don't know. I think maybe if somebody entrusts him with financing, he could continue on as a director, possibly. But, you know, and another director that has continued on in spite of publicity, bad behavior, is David O. Russell. I mean, he's got The
yeah.
Fighter. And yet his
yeah.
last movie nailed, the one right after I Heart Huckabee's, really got nailed. I mean, it
yeah.
didn't even get finished, I think.
I don't think it did get finished, which is really bizarre. Cause as far as I know, it had a pretty big cast, and it's a David O. Russell movie. I mean, it's not like any of his movies ever were successful, really.
Right.
You know, Flirting with Disaster is probably arguably his most successful movie, and most people have never heard of it, and it's full of very, very famous actors. It was essentially a directed DVD release.
Right.
So,
he's not the household name by any means that Mel Gibson is. He's known among people like us.
Right, and loved among people like us. I mean, I think I Heart Huckabee is one of the most interesting movies that's been made in many years, and really sort of brave. You know, I mean, like making a movie about existentialism with actors like actors like Dustin Hoffman and Lily Tomlin and things like that. Like, I mean, it's a really bizarre, funny, touching movie. But yeah, he clearly there's a problem, you know. I mean, like, from Three Kings to I Heart Huckabees to Nailed, these sort of issues keep plaguing him throughout his career, yet somehow he gets through the production of The Fighter, anyway, the filming of The Fighter, with guys like Christian Bale and Mark Wahlberg, two men that are known to be very volatile, and they get through fine, you know, like. So I don't know. Maybe it's when those guys roll together. Maybe Mel Gibson should have been in that movie when they roll.
Maybe they equalize each other. They balance
yeah.
each other out. They're and afraid of which
fighting,
which.
Fighting,
yeah.
no less.
That's true. I had not put that together. I mean, Christian Bale is another that, you know, they came out with his tape of his blow up on the Terminator Salvation set to the DP, and yeah,
yeah.
In the end, who cares? It's gossip fodder for a week. You know?
Yeah, it's gossip fodder. I do think that thing will stick. I think that people are sort of turning sour on Christian Bale. We just haven't had the chance to see it in the limelight yet. Because with the first Batman Begins movie, there was a little bit of backlash about his performance. Then with the second Batman movie, people are really, like, even people who love the movie and defend the movie as one of the greatest movies of all time, are not nuts about his performance. I'm not one
yeah.
of those. I like him in that movie. I like that he does the thing with his voice. I think it's interesting. It does seem like maybe Batman with all his money and Bruce Wayne could come up with some sort of voice disguiser thing or whatever. People have a big problem with that. And, of course, Terminator Salvation was not successful. I don't know. Like, I sort of wish he would get away from the action hero thing and get back to making movies like The Prestige and American Psycho and stuff like
that. The Machinist.
The Machinist. Oh, my gosh. Hopefully he will. I think he probably will. He seems like the kind of actor that would get really bored continually making action movies.
Yeah, you're right. But that is an interesting point. Nobody really brings up Christian Bale when they in the praise of The Dark Knight. And it's a unique thing because they bring up Heath Ledger, of course.
Yeah, right.
But it's a big thing where even the people that aren't necessarily movie savvy, I think a lot of them credit the direction. I mean, credit Chris Nolan. As far as their knowledge of what a director does takes them, you know. And I don't see that with anyone really outside of Spielberg, where the public is so aware of the man behind the camera on these big blockbusters.
Right, the public at large. Yeah, I think that they are aware of it just because of the name with somebody like M. Night Shyamalan. But I don't think they're aware. I don't think they're aware of it because of the product. And honestly, more people could probably tell you M. Night Shyamalan's name than could tell you Chris Nolan's name. But more of those same people do like what you're saying, which is recognize while they're watching the movie that they're in the hands of a very talented and unique filmmaker. Chris Nolan can make a movie with a relative unknown like Memento was with Guy Pearce. Most people didn't really know who he was at the time, despite L.A. Confidential. And people understand it's not about Guy Pearce. You know, it's about the filmmaker. It's about the way this film's being made.
Inception, I've been proud of the reviews because they haven't given away anything.
Yes.
I think they're respectful of the stance that this movie's taking. They want audiences to go in not knowing anything. But there have been superlatives across the board, stuff like Kubrick with a heart, and finally a movie where you don't know what's coming. It's completely original. It's a movie about ideas, and yet it has great emotion. Yeah.
Right, and a movie with brains that's also action-packed and exciting. Which is always a deadly combination. And by the way, always the combination that Chris Nolan brings, you know, always a brainy movie that is extremely exciting. And like he's somehow, I mean, he's on a hell of a run. He might be
is he like our singular human director version of Pixar where we're just waiting for him to drop the ball?
Well, that's what I was just about to say. Like, when you look at directors, like even the greatest directors like Spielberg and Scorsese, they really don't have long runs. Like, you'll get three or four really good movies, and then there'll be a turkey in there. The best example, probably, of a run for directors is the Coen brothers. In my opinion, it probably runs from Blood Simple all the way up to The Man Who Wasn't There. That's a period of, close to. I don't know, 17 years or something like that. Long run, and maybe, 10 titles or something like that. I mean, it's a very long run. Chris Nolan is approaching that. He's gone from Memento to Insomnia to Batman to
Prestige, Dark Knight.
And now Inception seems to fall completely in line. And I'm not talking about box office, because obviously Insomnia was not a huge hit, nor was The Prestige, for that matter.
Yeah,
I'm talking about great films.
Yeah, great films. You know, but I think that when a Chris Nolan flop occurs, it won't necessarily be because it's a bad movie. I think it'll still be an incredibly ambitious movie. And
well,
Go ahead.
I'm still not ruling out that could be Inception.
You're talking quality of movie or box office?
No. Absolutely not. No, I think it's a quality movie. Box office performance.
Right. Well, when I say flop, like deemed a creative failure as well as a box office one. I think if a Chris Nolan movie was deemed a creative failure, I could see it being a movie 30 years from now that will be reevaluated as a classic.
Yes, I know what you're saying. Sort of like William Friedkin's Sorcerer.
Yeah, or what they're doing to Heaven's Gate, or that kind of thing.
Right, right, right. Or even like Peter Fonda's The Hired Hand. There's a lot of love for that movie lately. You notice that?
Oh, really? Really?
I read two articles in the last year that mentioned that as like one of the forgotten classics of bygone era. I agree with you 100%, because he's such a strong filmmaker, he just doesn't make anything sort of half-hearted. And I'm not saying that Scorsese and Spielberg ever made anything half-hearted, although I do think that Spielberg has. But they have made things that were sort of misguided, you know, like they sort of believed that they could do anything. They came at a time when directors were sort of allowed to believe that they could do anything. And I think mm-hmm. Chris Nolan has learned from the history of film that you need to be smarter about the choices you make. Spielberg and Scorsese were handed the keys and basically said, you can make whatever you want. So, of course, they go off and make something like 1941 or New York, New York, or, you know, and it's just completely misguided, you know. I can do anything.
Yeah.
I don't think that Chris Nolan would ever make a wild, crazy decision like that.
I think every director, every major director you can point to and you could say, That's when it started. That's when the ego got the best of them. And these people are so empowered, as they should be. I mean, wouldn't you be empowered after you've made the first two Godfathers and the movie that should have been a debacle, Apocalypse Now, that turned out to be another classic film? And then wouldn't you think, man, I could do anything I want, one from the heart? You know, it's understandable in a way.
Right, you can really judge a director not only by their passion projects, but by how their passion projects are received. Is it going to be Judd Apatow's Funny People? You know, I mean, that was a passion project. He could have made any movie he wanted to, and that's what he chose to make was Funny People. Or is it going to be, Avatar? That was a passion project. You know, I mean, that was something that, his passion projects are a little bit bigger than everybody else's passion projects, but. I really do think you have to put Cameron in that category too. I mean, the guy
has
almost everything he makes is what you could put into that term passion, is that category passion project.
This is a conversation that I have with our friend Rick, who's done the show with us several times now, because he believes that, and I think he's in the chat room, so he could argue this. I think he believes that ego is getting the best of James Cameron. And that is quite possible. And if anyone is in a position to have an ego in the business, it is James Cameron, because he has decimated his naysayers with this latter part of his career.
I would say that ego is the best of James Cameron, actually. Like, not getting the best of James Cameron. I mean, it's hard to even think about it now, but before Titanic came out, we're talking about on the heels of True Lies, like, people were already sort of saying that his movies were too bombastic, and he's got another Last Action Hero in him. He's got a Last Action Hero in him. You know, he's going to make one of these big movies, and it's going to be a disaster. Oh, and it's going to be Titanic. This thing's getting too big, and people just aren't going to want to see this huge movie about a ship that crashed 100 years ago. And lo and behold, it's the greatest movie, the biggest movie of all time, wins Best Picture and 11 Oscars. And then, 10 years pass by, and people are like, how the hell is he going to follow that up? There's no way. Like, anything he makes is going to be a disappointment compared to Titanic. Oh, really? How about I make the most expensive movie, and I will also make it the most successful movie of all time, except I won't just squeak past my last record, which, by the way, holds number one. I will literally, like, just blow it out of its Titanic water, you know? Like, I mean, so...
Well, you're right. James Cameron operates on ego, where the technology doesn't exist to produce what he has in his head. He'll invent it. He's incredibly smart. I mean, this is a director that NASA talks to about missions to Mars. this is a guy that assembles a team together to talk about the oil spill. You know, he's got a lot of interests. He's a brainiac, but he's also incredibly creative. I think the point that Rick was making was he read an interview with Cameron where he said essentially he dismissed all of his movies prior to Titanic. He considered Titanic the start of his kind of career in a way of the James Cameron that he wants to be, is the impression that I got.
Well, so be it. So, you know, I mean, if that's the way he wants to look at his career, that's fine. You know, I mean, I wouldn't give up those movies. But if he wants to look at, like, that was his first movie where he was totally free and was able to really capture the kind of image, you know, I'm sure that's true. A lot of artists do that sort of thing. You know, I mean, Woody Allen dismisses his stuff. And I'm sure as a creative person, you look back on the stuff that you did when you were younger, and, you know, everybody else sees, oh, it's Terminator 2. It's that movie I saw when I was a kid, and I love it. And I love this part where, you know, T-1000 turns into a sword and slashes somebody in half and all that kind of stuff. Fine, you watch it as a fan, so that's how you remember it. Jim Cameron looks at it, and all he sees is what it doesn't look the way he wanted it to look, you know. So who can argue with what he is saying about his own work? I don't think anyone can. Having said that, I don't think Rick is wrong. Like, I do think the guy has a massive ego, like, but it's working for him, you know? I mean, I don't think we can argue with it at this point. Like, he probably will, and I sound like an asshole. I sound like one of those assholes from before Titanic who said he probably will make a flop at some point. The laws, and it's just like Nolan, you know? I mean, the laws say eventually he has to make something that's lesser. Eventually the Coen brothers made Intolerable Cruelty, and they made The Lady Killers. I don't know why. They were on such a roll. I don't know why they made these two movies that were somehow misguided, and I've gone back and watched them, and they really just are misguided.
Yes.
Somehow, Chris Nolan will probably make something that is relatively misguided. Probably won't be a disaster. Probably won't be a horrible movie. But I just don't see how it can last forever. Same with Jim Cameron.
Do you feel his best movies, though, were pre-Titanic?
I don't know. Define best. You know, I mean, the movies that appeal to me... Are Terminator and Aliens. I mean, I grew up with those kind of movies, so it's hard to say. I watched the VHS of Aliens until the thing broke. But having said that, Avatar was one of the top five movie-going experiences of my life. Like, I mean, I think people are already forgetting how great 3D was used in that movie and how uniquely 3D was used in that movie.
Yeah.
People are off the 3D bandwagon already, and it's unfortunate because I think the stuff that Cameron did with it was really special.
Well, you know, and he's doing the 3D conversion of Titanic that will be released in April of next year. No, not next year, 2012. So he's taking a long time with it. I think that will 3D be dead by then? If it is, he might be able to revive it with his 3D Titanic. I can see that being a massive hit. I can see people rushing back to re-experience Titanic in a new way.
Absolutely. The kind of thing that could easily make $100 million or more.
Yeah.
I can see that too. And the thing is, like, you feel like an asshole when you bet against Cameron. Like, I mean, you just feel you just don't want to do it. Like, any project he comes up with, I don't care what it is. Like, this Battle Angel, you know, when we were talking about Avatar for 5 years while he was making it, I was like, doesn't really sound like anything I'd want to see.
Right.
Well, lo and behold, it was really, you know, an interesting movie-going experience. The same way with his Battle Angel Alita movie that he's been talking about for, you know, 8 or 10 years. I don't know what the hell it's about, but...
Does that success change him in a way? I think kind of... It rings true to me in a certain way. I think it's wrong for him to say that he considers all of his movies a failure pre-Titanic, which he did in Entertainment Weekly. That's what.
That's
Rick
how he worded it.
Yeah.
That's how he worded it. Failure. Well,
yeah.
I think again, like I think probably what he meant was creatively, he was not able to accomplish it exactly the way he had it in his mind. Obviously, he's not calling Terminator 2 a failure, you know what I mean? I think what he's saying was, and I didn't read the article, but I have a hard time believing that he's talking about anything other than his the actual interpretation of what was in his mind.
Well, in a way, this it makes sense to me. I think post Titanic, with that level of success, he's got to be a different director. We might not want him to be a different director, but I think he might run into the syndrome of everything has to be huge. I don't think he can go do something more subtle, which subtlety is not James Cameron's strong suit. Anyway, I don't think he can make anything smaller. I don't think he can go make a character drama.
No, he's not going to go make a romantic comedy.
Yeah, James Cameron's Win in Rome. I can't wait for that. We got a caller, Judge Roy Bean. Let's take this call real quick. We got a lot of movie news to cover. Judge.
Hey, how does my sound?
Your sound is great. Are you on the beach?
Am I on the beach?
No.
All
right.
Does it sound like I'm on the beach?
No. We were talking about phone reception on the beach earlier.
Yeah, I know. I heard you. You know, I just wanted to go back to your Mel Gibson thing. You know,
okay.
God, I'm a great big fan of his, you know, and I hear you guys talking, and, you know, the one thing that I thought of is, and I'm sure you're aware of it, is that, you know, movies are political a little bit, but I think the fans do themselves a big disservice by getting involved in the actors' personal lives. It doesn't do us any good. It's not going to make any difference to me whether or not he hits his wife or not. I just enjoy his movies.
Right. So you would not have a problem watching Mel Gibson give a performance in a film and knowing that Mel Gibson himself is a wife beater?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't have a problem with it, no. In fact, I try not to hear this kind of thing because I don't want to think about those kinds of things because what they offer is, you know, is entertainment.
Right.
You know, if we were friends, you know, I'd have to hit him and leave. You know,
yeah,
kind of thing.
I agree with you. I don't think business wise, I don't think he's gonna find it easy to get any more chances really to do this thing.
Mm-hmm. Uh huh. What?
Go ahead, Chris.
Also, I don't know if I sort of understand what you're saying too, and I agree to a certain extent. You can say about Roman Polanski, like his movies are entertaining, and I like watching them. I don't care what he did 20 years ago. But Roman Polanski is still bringing quite a bit to the table creatively. I don't know that Mel Gibson brings enough to the table creatively anymore for me to write off what he's doing in his personal life. And by the way, where does it end? You know, okay, he made some anti-Semitic comments, and then we can all forget about that. Then he says he hopes his wife gets raped by a pack of N-words. Okay, and then we find out that he hit his wife who was holding a baby. Like, where does it end? Like,
does he have to kill 6 million Jews?
Right. I mean, if he goes to her house tomorrow and slices her throat, are we still going to be like, hey, what's up with Mad Max 4? You know, like, I don't know. At a certain point, and I feel like we've reached that point, I don't care anymore because he doesn't bring enough to the table.
And, you know, I heard you made the point about Roman Polanski, and evidently they're...
Are you there? You broke up a little bit. Are you still there?
Testing 1, 2, 3. Can you hear
me? Okay, you're back. You're back.
I heard not you, but the other guy. I'm not good with this
Chris.
Yet. I haven't...
Chris, yes.
Yeah, I heard you make the analogy or the example of Roman Polanski, and... gosh, man, I'd have more against a guy for having sex with an underage girl than a guy that hits a grown-up.
I don't know. It's hard for me to rank those two. Like, those are two. on a scale of 0 to 10 of things that piss me off, those are both pretty close to a 10, you know? I mean, like, I don't know. I have a hard time saying which one's worse. But the saving grace for Roman Polanski is The Ghost Rider, or The Ninth Gate, or The Pianist, versus Mel Gibson, who's making, you know, again, he's making good movies, but I just don't feel like he's brought enough to the table creatively for me to wipe it from my mind. And also, what Roman Polanski did was awful, but it happened 35 years ago or something like that. Whereas
and you
Mel
can
Gibson,
also say that she looked 20 or whatever, and it's easy for people to justify that in their mind.
Look, I can we can all divide this. What these people have done, they're terrible things. But we would do a disservice to ourselves as film fans to ignore their movies when some of them are major films that can be appreciated because of their behaviors.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
I always felt that way about Scorsese. When everybody protested Last Temptation of Christ, which I didn't agree with the protest in the first place, but they said, I am never watching another Scorsese movie again. I could not imagine neglecting myself from not watching Cape Fear or Casino or, you know, all these great films that mean a lot to me in my life, you know.
And that's what I was...
Okay, well, your call dropped out again. I'm sorry, Judge. I'm going to have to sentence you to caller imprisonment. I'm sorry.
the other thing is, this guy's making a product. He's making a product, and his product is a movie. And if you buy his product, you are endorsing his movie, you're endorsing him. And that's the way I look at it. And ultimately, it's just like any business. A business pisses me off. They act in a way that I don't like. I don't care how good their burgers are. If I get bad service, I'm not going back there anymore because there's someone else who makes, you know, I mean, their burgers are really good, but down the street is another place that makes really good burgers. And Mel Gibson is awesome, and I like what he does creatively, but I don't like it enough to support him beating his wife or him saying that he hopes his wife gets raped by a pack of N-words. And listen, I'm a fan of wordplay, and I think that's a little bit funny.
You know, the all-time greatest was, what are you looking at, sugar tits? We have Mel Gibson to thank for that. Yeah.
Guy's kind of a comedian, and it's awesome.
He's the Don Rickles of anti-Semites, really.
Right, of anti-Semites and racists. But I just don't – listen, I just – I like the guy's product. I don't like him.
I think if this is a good – I like that we've had this conversation for the past two shows because it is shaded. I mean, it's personal perception, but there are lots of pros and cons and what-ifs, you know, to this. So
right.
It's something to ponder.
Also, the whole thing happened with the anti-Semitism comment, and his whole thing was he apologized for it. And, you know, he's like, listen, I was drunk. I made some comments I shouldn't have. I need to learn to control my anger and all this stuff. Here we are 2 years later, and he's making more comments. And, by the way, he's making them on a answering machine or something like that. It's like, well, you obviously didn't learn anything, did you, asshole? you know, I mean, I just don't – it's like, fool me once. Okay, let's do it again. Christian Bale, I think that he came off like a monster asshole on that recording. But I don't care. Like, I'm like, all right, let's, you know, that's one. We'll give you a mulligan. I we're forgetting about it. But if another recording comes out with him being an asshole, I'm going to start considering whether I want to see Christian Bale movies anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And we faced this when we did our Polanski show, because it broke around the rape, the retrial of the rape when he was picked up again. And question, you know, should we go through with it? But there were movies to be discussed and explored, and a fascinating life behind those movies, which made it worthy of a retrospective special on him. It wasn't an endorsement of his behavior. It was an endorsement of a separate part of him, his creative output.
Also, Roman Polanski gets a pass for the Holocaust. And he gets a pass for, you know, his wife being murdered by the most famous, you know, psychopath of our generation, of you know, this century. So,
yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I didn't give him a pass for that. But his
joking.
I know, dude. I know you. But his work cannot be denied.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It just can't be.
Right. He brings more to the table. Like, you can deny Edge of Darkness.
Yes.
Well, I mean, it was decent.
Edge of Darkness is not Rosemary's Baby.
Right. Or even The Ghost Rider. Like, Polanski has a long, rich history of making really, really solid movies. We're talking
By the way, I heard that Roman Polanski was holding Rosemary's Baby when Mel Gibson punched him in the face. I don't know if that's true. I got to read some listener mail. A listener got on to me because I didn't read their email to us last week. So this is from Jonathan Kelly. He said, I'm absolutely loving the podcast airing this week and last week. It's bringing out the amazing memories. He wanted us to talk about the Persian, I think it's Pusan International Film Festival. I'm probably massacring that name. It is the leading film festival in Asia, but much more than that, it is as amazing as any of the global leading film festivals. I don't believe that it gets the attention that it deserves or the credit in screening the most important films of the year. They had an amazing Dario Argento retrospective, and I was only a few feet away from the master when he did his handprint and signature. Admission to the movies cost about $5, which is the best part. At the 2009 film festival, I saw Bonnie and Clyde, Easy Rider, Midnight Cowboy, Deep Red, Chicago Heights, Ward No. 6, Deliver Us from Evil. They also screened White Ribbon and many other films. He gave us a link. We'll post the link in the chat room. I think it's important that your listeners know that there is a vibrant cinematheque and film festival scene occurring in Korea where the leading films are screened, and it is comparable to any of the cinema capitals of the world. And he also wanted, when Inception comes around, for us to talk about Inception and the possible connection it has to Dreamscape, which actually I've read a couple of reviews that have referenced Dreamscape in relation to Inception.
Yeah,
you remember that movie, Dreamscape?
I do, with Dennis Quaid. It's an easy connection to make. I mean, there's not a lot of movies made about dreams, so, you know.
How about In Dreams from Neil Jordan?
In Dreams? Well, also there was one by Kurosawa, was there not?
Dreams? Yeah.
Yeah. I can't believe the name was escaping me for a second there. yeah, no, I don't know. Kind of hard to talk about Inception because we haven't seen it, but... If anyone thinks that this is a movie that's not going to get talked about on this show, then you obviously do not listen to this show.
Oh, yeah. We're going to talk about it ad nauseum once we see it. We got another listener email, and I can't find it, but they love our I forget where he wrote from, but they love our Inside the Classics and the New Classics series, and they want us to consider Once Upon a Time in America as one of the next movies that we cover. Sergio Leone. I know there's a lot of love out there for that movie.
I like that movie too, but I would be more inclined to salute Once Upon a Time in the West. That's just me. Once Upon a Time in America is a great movie. I don't know, the movies that you salute, you sort of choose them because they're movies that you know that all three, even though I don't usually participate in those shows, you sort of know that all three of us sort of on the same page about those movies. Is that correct?
Yes.
Typically, you know, I mean, that's
part of the
criteria. It'd be kind of hard to salute a movie, even if it was just you and Jerry talking about it, if only you loved it. So.
Well, you know, we're doing a tribute, like a celebration of Pauline Kael at the end of the month, and I really want critics that love her as well as loathe her on.
Well, there is an abundance of both.
Which is great, which I think speaks to her, how much fire people have for her, what her legacy is. So I'd like them both to go at it. Another listener, Tommy 1986, I forget where he's from. I think it's out of the country, too, but get a lot of international listeners. He wrote us to during our 80s podcast to kind of recommend some films to cover. And I made a joke that we're just holding our breath to do our Sylvester Stallone over the top tribute. And he wrote us and he said, by the way, Jamie, I hope you were serious about a tribute show to Over the Top. I'd love to learn more about that film. It's one that definitely deserves further analysis.
You know,
Tommy,
it's an interesting,
I love you, but no, it's not going to happen.
Well, he does bring up an interesting point though. Maybe not over the top, but we have a tendency to sort of salute the movies that are kind of true classics and sort of over-serious, but I think maybe we need to consider saluting a movie that's not over the top, but Cobra, or Anaconda, you know, a movie that is sort of a cult classic and a little bit ridiculous, like a classic because it's so ridiculous. I think we need to maybe consider that.
I would be open to that, but more so in not necessarily a movie like Over the Top, which is just bad, but a movie that had promise. The elements should have been there, but for some reason it didn't happen. I'd like to kind of something like Geely, which is a notorious bad movie, and yet in it contains so much kind of talent and interesting notions that don't mesh together. I mean, it's a mess. But how did it become a mess, you know? I think that would be an interesting movie to examine.
It would be an interesting movie to examine. I do think a lot of that stemmed from the relationship between Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez. Like, those characters, as written in... I'll bet that was a pretty good screenplay. The thing is, if you read it, it'd be sort of hard to not think of Affleck and Lopez in those parts. But, you know, I mean, story about a hitman and another assassin who is a woman, and she's a lesbian, she's kind of tough, and... You know, I mean, I'll bet it was an interesting screenplay, but though the casting was all wrong for those two parts, and it certainly was wrong being that they were in a relationship and very high profile at the time. But yeah, that would be interesting to sort of look at a movie like that that should have worked but did not.
Yeah.
Cobra is not one of those movies, so.
Cobra works like mad, like gangbusters,
right.
Man.
Right. Cobra works because it does not work.
That's right. Everything wrong with Cobra is oh so right.
Exactly. Commando, likewise.
It is his Commando. I mean, Schwarzenegger's Commando is on par with Stallone's Cobra for me.
Oh my God, that's what I'm saying. Those two movies. Oh, and talk about a double feature. Oh,
but great! I can't imagine a better '80s double feature than those two.
No. You can't imagine one.
I mean, seeing Schwarzenegger like carry that big tree over his shoulder in the opening credits. It's great. It's so great. I tell you what, an incredibly funny movie is opening up in New York this Friday and throughout the rest of the country in the following month. It's a documentary that I saw a couple of years ago, and it's called Winnebago Man. Michael Morris said this is the funniest documentary he's ever seen. It's getting raves all over the place, and I was raving about it years ago. Do you know the viral video back in the 80s where a guy, it's an infomercial for the Winnebago, and this guy is hosting it, and it's all the outtakes, and he comes across as a major jerk. He's cursing, he's flubbing lines and cursing at the crew and throwing things at them, throwing fits. Have you seen this YouTube video?
No, I haven't. I'm not aware of this at all.
Is allowed.
Hey, am I on the air? Hello?
Sounds like you're back.
Okay. Man, this phone, my face is so fat, if I like press it up against the phone, it hangs up. I'm so sorry. Anyway, the movie is called Winnebago Man, and it's interesting in that this is a viral sensation. It's really taken over pop culture. And you see how Hollywood stars have kind of are imitating the Winnebago Man, you know, in press junkets and things. It's really, it's a hysterical kind of sensation. The real name of the Winnebago Man is Jack Rebney. This filmmaker made it his goal to track down Jack Rebney, who was completely unaware that he's caused such a viral sensation. And so not only do you finally meet this mysterious figure in Jack Rebney, and he's a very colorful guy. It also explores the nature of viral video, its place in our culture. And it's very touching, too, because Jack Rebney kind of meets the public that is so enamored of him, because they have annual film festivals for viral videos. And it's a real communal experience where everyone sits and laughs and has a great time watching these things screened. It's a great movie. Let me play a quick trailer for it, because I'd like to promote it, and then we'll be right back after this.
All right, here we go.
The Winnebago Concepts and Engineering Departments have developed a multifunctional bathroom. Privacy, I don't even know what the f*** I'm reading. I'm going to slate this f***. You big dumb son of a... I don't want any more bull from anyone. That includes me.
I love this clip. I watch it like every time I'm in a bad mood.
Oh, so I've seen this like hundreds of times. That guy's a legend.
Yep.
Make my mind work.
Jack Rebney would be the holy grail of stars to meet from these videos.
We could never find him, so we just assumed he was gone.
You start to think, well, who is this guy? What happened to him?
That's weird. There's no property. There's no cars. There's no voter registration.
What does that mean?
You don't want anybody to really know who you are and what you're about.
This is Jack Rebney. It's inconceivable to me that you would have any interest in this, but if you want to talk, I'm interested.
Hello, I'm Jack Rebney. I'm known as the angriest man on earth.
Accoutrement that you will need. Accoutrement? What is that?
Jack has always wanted an audience.
I just don't think that you're taking advantage of this group of people that you can talk to.
I have no relationship with YouTube.
The only thing it will come to is
how this guy's been crazy all his life.
I'll give you a couple of diatribes.
Action Jack.
How's your audio? Is everything all right there?
Security guard right there.
Call the police now. Get the Gestapo.
Want to talk about me?
Yeah.
I'm very old. I'm very crotchety. What else is new?
If you don't like it, pack up. Get the f*** out.
You believe any of that? Get out of here, you flies.
You got to see this video. But a couple of years ago, I really recommended put my full force behind Dear Zachary and another astounding documentary. And this year, I'm putting it behind Winnebago Man. It's like the must-see. In the documentary realm of the year, I think. So check it out. What else is there to talk about? Mad Max, we mentioned that before. That's been pushed back. I'm not terribly upset by that.
Yeah, I like the Mad Max movies, but they're going to make one with a different guy, and it's 20 years after the last Mad Max movie. I feel like we could just let it die. I couldn't really care that much either, you know. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Who cares? Like, I'm so over them making the same movies. So over them making the same movies over and over and over and over again, and just going back to the well. And so I feel the exact same way. Who cares?
Yeah. Well, there was something. It was mentioned a couple of weeks ago on our show. That the studios are looking less at sequels now and asking for more original content. But this thing is so cyclical, if another sequel hits it big, then they'll change their mind again. But the good news is Inception, if that's big, maybe it'll give them the wherewithal to stick to that mandate.
Big, yeah. Rated PG-13, isn't it?
Yeah, you know what else is rated PG-13?
What?
The Tree of Life. There is a group of, I was telling Rick tonight, there is a group of parents out there, because the MPAA is comprised of, you know, different, you know, people of all walks of life, but generally they're parents, that have seen Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life.
Uh-huh.
And they've given it a PG-13. This is one of these movies that every morsel of information that comes in about it, the film geeks are going to jump all over because it's so mysterious. How can it? Yeah, all we know about it makes it even more mysterious. Sean Penn, Brad Pitt, 1950s American family, juxtaposed with footage of dinosaurs, like state of the art IMAX CGI dinosaurs. Which makes it an even more, like, you know, what the F kind of movie.
Yeah, Terrence Malick is enough for me, but you put in all that other stuff. Yeah, I mean, it is fascinating. I don't know, like, what is it with this guy? He's so mysterious and weird. And even his movies that don't work, like the Thin Red Line, it's just so, I don't know, it's like got this ethereal like quality to it.
Yeah,
when it's on cable, I still can't stop watching it, even though I know that it's not, the movie doesn't work for me, but...
It doesn't work for me either. The New World really works for me, and I didn't expect
absolutely. It to. Yeah, it works extremely well. It works so well that I was kind of shocked that it wasn't sort of recognized a little bit more for working as well as it did. It's one of those movies that came out, actually, I think, like right around the same time as Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. Two movies came out pretty close together, and it was like, hey, what the hell? What's everybody talking about? Like, I think Babel was the movie everybody was talking about at the time, and it's like...
Yeah, they needed to be talking about those two, The New World and Melquiades Estrada.
Good Lord. Like, I just don't think people respond to those kind of movies anymore. I think that's part of the problem.
Well, encouraging, take encouragement, I guess, from the fact that Malick has said this is his best movie since Badlands. And his longtime production designer, Jack Fisk, has said the same thing. And
Well, the thing is, if other people say that, that would be, it's better than the last 15 movies I made. But with him, so there's only been two movies in between there, so, you know, or three.
It's the best movie I've made since the last movie I made 30 years ago.
Yeah, doesn't really mean that much.
But I love Badlands. Badlands is one of the classics of the 70s. I mean,
unsung.
I think so, yeah. And so blatantly duplicated and uncredited. So many copycats. I think the closest credit it got was, I don't even know if they did that with True Romance, where the score for True Romance is the same score from Babylon.
Yeah, they literally rip off that same little like xylophone riff and use the exact same thing. And I don't know if they do credit it or if they did the whole Vanilla Ice thing and changed one note and called it a different score. But you could take that movie, that music out of True Romance, and it still owes heavily to Badlands. You put the music back in, and it owes quite a bit, like, to Badlands. And that's not the only example. There's any male-female on the run, you know, sort of getaway-type movie.
Well, yeah, and Bonnie and Clyde came previous to that. Obviously.
Yeah.
Are there movies that that you've seen recently that bear discussion, that warrant discussion?
No. in fact, it's weird. I'm on vacation right now. Well, my family always has we do our family reunion here at Amarillo Island every year on the 4th of July. And we always, you know, we do 3rd of July is my birthday, 4th of July is 4th of July. You know, and then afterwards, maybe on the 5th or the 6th, we all get together and go to a movie or something like that. And there's just nothing. I mean, there's just nothing that holds any interest for me whatsoever at the movie theater right now.
Yeah.
And I keep going back and looking at the listings. It's like when you look at you open up the fridge and there's nothing in there you want to eat, and then an hour later you walk back to the fridge and you open it back up, like there's going to be magically some new food in there that you didn't see before. I keep doing that with the newspaper and with the internet, like looking like, God, there's got to be some movie we can all go see, and, you know, there's just not.
No.
I mean, probably right now, like, the slew of movies that are in the are at your multiplex right now are probably the worst, like, motley crew of awful movies. I mean, you're talking, with the exception of Toy Story 3, I mean, you're just talking about stuff like Grown Ups and The Last Airbender and Eclipse and Karate Kid and A-Team and all this bullshit. And it's just so...
Horrible year, but especially a horrible summer. So far.
Yeah, I mean, it's been actually the last 3 years, 2008, 2009, and so far 2010, just like every year, there's been some gems in there, there's been some jewels, but we are in a major, major lull for American filmmaking right now. This year has truly turned out to be the worst of the last three so far. I mean, it's been really bad. I mean, I'm excited about Predators this week just because it's something that holds, you know, a sort of mild interest for me. But it's certainly not something I think is going to be, you know, a good movie. So Inception, I think, is going to be a high point. And then if you look at the schedule, we're really into a lot of lows after that. So
yeah, with a couple of high points in the fall, as usual. But even so, The Last Airbender still made $70 million in spite of the worst.
By all accounts, the worst reviews
of the year.
Yeah. I mean, it's got like a 7% approval rating or something like that. Something so atrocious. I don't know. So that means it made $70 million. Like, it'll easily pass 100, probably get to 150 or something like that, international. So I guess that means this guy continues to make movies, which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
maybe he continues to make Last Airbender movies.
I thought it might have had a big weekend, opening weekend, because of the popularity of the anime, and that it's a family movie. But if it's as bad as everyone says it is, and I'm not going to go out and watch it, if it's as bad as everybody says it is, you're going to see it die now.
Well, yeah,
I think it might reach $100 million in the U.S.
Oh, no, it'll absolutely reach $100 million in the U.S. It's got $70 million so far, like, in the opening weekend. If it drops 60%, it still makes it to $100 million. Like, it will absolutely...
Look, I don't got a calculator here, Chris. I can't tell you for sure.
Well, I can do those numbers in my fucking head, and I'm a retard. So.
What do I look like, Rain Man to you?
Yeah, I'm a retard. So, no, I mean, it'll make $100 million. It'll probably make more than that international, obviously. Even though internationally it's probably more offensive than it is here. I don't know, like, what is going on? Like, I don't understand why people are so... And this one, I don't think is because of M. Night Shyamalan. I think it's, like you said, it's because kids like the TV show, Avatar: The Last Airbender. But I almost feel like we should just sort of stop talking about it. Like, we should all, like, collectively decide to stop watching Jersey Shore so they'll stop putting it on TV. Like, we should do the same thing with Shyamalan. Like, we'd all stop talking about it, stop going to his movies, because... I don't think that there's much there. Like, I really don't. Like, it's like we were talking about with Chris Nolan earlier. I don't think he's a smart filmmaker. I don't think he cares about his audience the way that Chris Nolan does, the way that James Cameron does. I don't think that he cares enough to really put the sort of thought into his movies like those guys do.
There's an interesting theory about Shyamalan, though.
What is
that? That his trouble all started with Signs. I like Signs. I think it's the last good movie he did. But look at the three principals in Signs. Shyamalan, Mel Gibson, and Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah. Have run into trouble ever since.
Yes. So they're blaming that craziness on Signs. It is ironic.
Abigail Breslin doesn't hold...
Yeah, it's just a matter of time. She's the Drew Barrymore in waiting. I did my top 10. Speaking of the poor quality of the half year point, I did my top 10 movies of the half year point on our friend Jason's show the other night. Let me share with you what they are, because I know you're breathless with anticipation. My number 10 was Ondine. Colin Farrell mermaid movie. I say mermaid movie, but that's not really what it is. But
no, it's not. Although that's what it pretends to be.
Yeah. My number 9 was I Love You, Philip Morris. I checked it out.
Did you?
Yeah. And you're right. Yeah. It's among the funniest stuff Jim Carrey's done in that first hour.
Yeah.
And the first hour of the movie works. I think it kind of loses its way in the second half of it, for me.
Obviously heavily chopped up in the second half, yeah.
Mm-hmm. A great, fascinating, colorful life filled with incident, but that didn't they weren't necessarily able to translate that into an interesting full movie.
That's exactly how I felt, yeah.
if you get a chance to see it, the first hour alone is Jim Carrey gold.
It's worth it, yeah.
Yeah. My number 8 is Greenberg. Have you checked that out yet?
I have not. I've not gotten the opportunity to, unfortunately, no.
It's interesting. I don't know your relationship to Noah Baumbach movies anyway.
I love him. I've loved all of his movies recently. And I loved all of his early movies. So.
I did love Squid and the Whale. I did really like. I really liked Margot at the Wedding. This one is another disengaged character. I mean, somebody that he feels like a stranger in his own life. He's not able to connect with others because he can't really connect with himself. And it's his Noah Baumbach's movie set in L.A., which is perfect because that's the sprawling city that is disconnected.
Right. Well, yeah.
I just as I was watching it, I both sympathized with the lead character and I said, you know, snap out of it, quit whining. I felt impatient with him.
That's the same way I felt with the people in Kicking and Screaming, the people in Mr. Jealousy, Squid and the Whale, and Margot at the Wedding. Like, he makes movies about very unlikable people. He's the opposite of Nancy Meyers. Nancy Meyers makes movies with only likable people. Noah Baumbach makes movies with only unlikable people.
This is an interesting question, though, because there are directors that work on variations of a particular theme throughout their career.
Sure.
Do you think it's valuable for those kinds of artists, and I'm putting Noah Baumbach in that category, to break out of that theme in order to grow? Or is it just acceptable that they can find growth exploring that same theme?
I think it's perfectly acceptable for someone to find growth exploring the same themes over and over again. It's sort of akin to someone like walking up to Jackson Pollock and going, hey, why don't you just paint a still life? You know, like, what's up? Like, what's up with the splatter paint? And, you know, it looks like a big mess. It looks like spaghetti. Like, how about I give you a big chunk of granite and you bang away on it till it looks like, you know, Michelangelo's David. That's not what he does. Like, I mean, that's not what he goes to the canvas and he has nothing in mind but to create. And what he creates is this sort of work. And that's what happens with Woody Allen, and that's what happens with Noah Baumbach, and that's what happens with lots of guys. I mean,
that's a great analogy. That's a great analogy.
That's
I haven't thought of
what happens with James Cameron too. I mean, James Cameron has been banging away on the same themes his whole career. He just does it on a much bigger canvas.
Yeah. Remind me, I want to talk to you about a Kennedy project before we close off. Number 7 is Brooklyn's Finest on my list, which I really enjoyed. Number 6 is a doubleheader. It's the Joan Rivers documentary, A Piece of Work, and a new documentary on Hugh Hefner called Hugh Hefner, Playboy Activist and Rebel. I had no idea Hugh Hefner's influence in the latter part of the last century. It goes beyond Playboy. This movie really focuses on the differences he made in civil rights, in writing social injustices. I mean, this is certainly one of the most fascinating lives of the past century, but he's really shaped a lot more than our perceptions on sexual boundaries and taboos. I mean, it's really far reaching. And so this is an eye opening documentary. We'll be covering it later on in the month with the director. My number 5 is a movie called Unthinkable. It's a direct to DVD movie with Samuel Jackson and Carrie Ann Moss and Michael Sheen.
Mm-hmm.
You can find it on Redbox. My number 4 is The Crazies. My number 3 is Shutter Island, because in spite of the flaws that we both find in Shutter Island, I think in terms of genuine craft and cinematography and performance, on those levels, it's pretty hard to beat.
Hey, listen. I don't think Shutter Island works, but Shutter Island at this point is like the... it's like the chick in the bar at 1:55 in the morning. Like, she's a 6, but she's there and she's interested. You know, like she's fucking listening to you, she's looking at you, and she's, you know, yeah, all right. So she's got one eye that goes funny, but she's got nice lips, and you know, like.
That's great. My number 2 is Toy Story 3. And my number one is The Ghost Rider. So it'll be interesting to see how many of those fly off the list at the end of the year and how many stay. Oh, but
I could almost tell you right now which ones it'll be. But I have a recommendation for you. I don't know if you saw it, but did you see the Michael Cera movie, Youth in Revolt?
I haven't seen it, but I understand you thought it was very funny.
I did think it was very, very funny. It's not a perfect movie. It's got flaws, but it's full of dialogue that is hilarious, and it's another split personality kind of movie, but it's got a sort of, Fight Club meets American Pie or something like that. But I find Michael Cera to be very charming and extremely hilarious, and it's a movie that made me laugh out loud many, many times. Got a great cast. Him, M. Emmett Walsh is in it. Steve Buscemi is in it. Fred Willard is in it. Justin Long. A lot of good little moments in it. And it's kind of got something to say, too, about youth and that sort of time when you're sort of transitioning from a boy into a man. And I thought it was a really interesting movie that took me by surprise. So.
Okay, so that's on DVD now, correct?
Absolutely. I've seen it twice already.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
There's a movie.
There's another one I want to talk to you about, by the way, before we go off the air. It's another movie.
Okay, don't forget it. There's a project that's being made right now on the Kennedys, on John F. Kennedy in particular. It could be about the whole family, though. I don't know. It's a mini series for the History Channel. Greg Kinnear plays JFK, and Katie Holmes plays Jackie Kennedy.
Really?
Yeah. Now, the liberal media, and I think it's safe to say, you and I both, if we had to be categorized, it would be as, liberals.
We swing left. Okay. We swing left, yeah.
Yes. I am left of Barney Frank, which, by the way, I, as I understand it, that's just how he likes it.
Yeah, which means
so,
you're blowing him, by the way.
It's terrible. Anyway, the liberal media is all on top of this movie. They're outraged by it. Because it apparently has very conservative right-wing perspectives and talents behind the camera and writing it and directing it. It's a right-wing project, so they see a smear job on the horizon.
Right.
This is where I fall on it, and then I'll get your take. The liberals need to get over it, get over themselves, because I mean, they make the majority of movies. Their views are articulated a lot more than conservative views. I've always said, if I would be completely open to more kind of right-wing movies. I watched the right-wing response to Fahrenheit 9/11. Very few others did because it didn't have access. And I think that kind of sucks, but that's the nature of Hollywood, I guess. So one movie's coming out that has a right-wing perspective, I think liberals need to shut the hell up and just live with it.
I agree. They sort of get used to owning the media. No shit. Like, what do you think? You're going to get to hammer away on George Bush all day long and no one's going to make a movie that criticizes, your heroes like Bill Clinton or Franklin Roosevelt or JFK? I agree. Like, let the Republicans make any movie they want to make. It's probably miscated. I don't care what movie you make, like what points you bring up. The guy got his head blown off for his country, so I don't think it's going to persuade anyone. Go ahead. If you think that's the angle you want to take, go right ahead. Please knock yourself out.
It's I'd be interested in seeing what it has to say. Obviously, it's a family that has a lot of controversy and the whiffs of scandal, but as does most public lives, as do most public lives now,
Yeah.
So I'm all for it. I just they don't have a voice really in Hollywood, and I guess it's because Hollywood is mostly liberal, But if there was a really successful conservative movie, I'm sure they'd make those movies because they're in it for money more than ideology. Do you think?
Interesting question. Because there really haven't been, and there's no examples of a successful conservative movie that jumps to mind anyway. I mean, obviously, lots of movies that are very liberal that are made that are successful, but even a movie that is sort of metaphorically conservative, like you really just don't have a lot of examples of that, let alone blatantly conservative or Republican.
Yeah,
I do think that if they discovered that there were a market for that kind of movie, and I'll bet there is, if they discovered that in Hollywood, they would continue to make them, I think.
The only conservative movie that we have of recent years is something of the quality of the Zucker movie, whatever that
That is the one that has jumped to my mind numerous times during this conversation. And there are people that are sort of known conservatives in Hollywood. I mean, obviously Clint Eastwood is a conservative guy. I don't think he's across the board conservative, but he's a known conservative.
But he doesn't make movies that necessarily reflect those feelings. Those
certainly
views.
Not. Certainly not. No, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. In fact, Gran Torino has a very, you could argue a pretty liberal view socially anyway. So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, there's lots of guys that are Republican, that are conservative, and you just don't see that in Bruce Willis,
yeah, yeah.
You would never know that, but he is.
Rick in the chat room agrees with me. Rick, feel free to call in. We have a few minutes left, and we can find something to discuss in the last few minutes if you'd like.
I want to talk quickly about.
Yes.
You don't know Jack. You don't know Jack.
Oh, you did. You finally got around to watching that. Okay.
I did finally get around to watching it. So it was a pretty good movie. You know, it's an 8. But Pacino's performance, and I don't want to get. I don't want to get too up on my high horse about it here, but it's the, like, hands down the best Pacino performance in maybe 20 years. I mean, it's...
Really?
I mean, it just completely surpasses everything he's done. What Pacino has not been able to do in recent years, certainly in the last 10, 15 years, is sort of disappear into a character.
Mm-hmm,
even in movies
mm-hmm.
where he's very good, where you can watch it and, you know, like Heat or Scent of a Woman or The Insider, where you watch it a couple times, and you need to sort of watch it a couple times to appreciate his performance. He hasn't had a performance in a long time that sort of blows you away on first viewing it, the way
yeah.
that Tony Montana did in Scarface, or the Dog Day performance did, or Michael Corleone or something like that. People tend to, maybe Donnie Brasco, but actually I think his Jack Kevorkian is even better than Donnie Brasco. Like, I mean, he disappears into this character within minutes of watching the movie. I mean, you only get a couple of seconds to remember that it's Al Pacino at the very beginning of the movie. After that, he fucking disappears into that role.
That's beautiful.
It's unbelievable. I mean, do you?
I love it. I love it that you say that. I obviously, because he's my all-time favorite actor. Anyone that knows the show knows that. But
yeah, but you're
when
able
I watch...
to you're able to be realistic about his performances.
Yes.
And realize that in the last 10 years or 15 years, even for the most part, he's been very lazy as an actor.
For the most part,
on the screen.
Yeah, for the most part, I agree with you. Even though there have been gems, there have been there's Insomnia that I love him in. There's
Donnie Brasco
and Merchant of Venice.
Merchant of Venice and Insomnia. Those three gems, I agree, they take sort of repeated viewings to appreciate the kind of subtleties in his performance. They're very subtle performances, but brilliant. You Don't Know Jack isn't like that. I mean, it's like fucking Heath Ledger and the Joker or something like that.
There is not. He cannot rely on bombast in this movie.
Right.
So there's it's not a showboaty performance.
No.
It can't be. And there's the physicality. There's the subtlety. He is an incredibly subtle actor when given when he's directed towards that.
Right.
He's an actor that needs direction.
I think he needs to work with Barry Levinson again because, I mean, literally, he hasn't been like this. I mean, we might have to go back to something like Scarface since he's been.
Well, and Dog Day Afternoon is another performance where, after a time, I stop seeing Pacino and I see this desperate character of Sonny.
Right. Right, right.
And I think this is, while not certainly not that level of movie, I think it can be that level of performance. The movie I was kind of, it's good, not great, but Pacino is amazing, and it's so much so, and I said this after I saw it, that when I think Kevorkian after seeing that movie, I see Pacino.
Yeah.
Which I think is the greatest compliment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, sort of like when you think Hunter S. Thompson, a lot of people now think Johnny Depp is here in Loathing in Las Vegas, as opposed to the real guy who you really just don't see that much. You know, I mean, Jack Kevorkian, we all know, we've all seen pictures of him in Time magazine, but you don't have a lot of time seeing him talk, seeing him act and things, you know, seeing him, you know, give his opinion and things like that. I mean, there was a 60 Minutes piece probably about a year ago about Kevorkian after he got out of prison.
Yeah.
He doesn't even really look exactly like him. He's not quite as thin and lanky as Kevorkian was, but it doesn't matter.
He inhabits him, and in a yeah.
Right, right. He completely disappeared. Like, I literally had to keep reminding myself that it was Al Pacino as I was watching it because he was so believable, so completely immersed in his character. And by the way, it's not someone who I was terribly familiar with. It's not like, oh, wow, he really got that voice down. No, like, I didn't even really know that Kevorkian had that sort of Midwest accent. Like,
yeah.
He just completely disappeared into what was, and like you said, a decent movie, but not great. But it did have a very well-written character. The guy is not likable. Like, I mean, he's likable. You agree with what he's trying to do, but he, the person, is someone who you don't want to spend a lot of time around. He's a very difficult, sort of obtuse person.
Right, right.
And Pacino plays that character so well. I mean, he's like someone that you just want to ask to leave the room, you know? Like, all right, you're annoying everyone in the room. We get it, you know? Like, and everybody knows someone like that. And he just nailed it. I was so happy to see Pacino nail it like that, you know? It's been so long. And now my thing is you need to answer back De Niro and Dustin Hoffman and all these kind of guys that – it's sort of also been coasting for a little bit here. Pacino has called back to the heyday of his career with this performance. Like, I mean, he is really thrown down in a lesser movie and one that's not going to be seen by everybody. It's a TV movie. But performance-wise, he has sort of called back to the heyday of his career here.
I'm glad you think that. I think those changes. I think a change is happening with Pacino in that.
I hope so.
With his screen work, he's realizing the perception out there and his missteps. I think he's preparing. I think he's working on the end of his career in a way, and he will act up until the day he dies. I have no doubt about it because he has such a passion for it. But and you see it in his choices for the most part, where he's done Kevorkian. Talk about end of life, end of career. He's doing Merchant of Venice. It's probably going to go on Broadway next in the New York Shakespeare in the Park. He's signed on to do King Lear with Michael Radford, which is a big swan song for any great actor.
Yeah.
So I think he's reached that point. I think he recognizes that maybe I said yes to certain movies because of loyalties to certain filmmakers. You know, and they weren't in the best interest of me, for me and my growth.
Right. I hope so, because
I always felt the fire with him.
Yeah, you can always feel the fire. Like, you can always feel – but the thing is, you believe he, as an actor, just has that fire and is able to get in touch with that fire. Like, he can read the script for Righteous Kill, and maybe he recognizes that it's not the greatest script in the world, but he's able to call upon that fire that he always has. So but he can, you know, read lines from that awful script and make it interesting and make it exciting for 2 minutes. But that's not going to save the rest of the script. That's not going to save the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
And he did this time and again with Two for the Money and The Recruit and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, okay, yeah, there's a couple scenes where he can call upon that fire, whether it's a scene where he's screaming or not screaming. He's great when he's screaming. He's great when he's subtle. He's great when he's quiet. But the whole project that he's choosing just doesn't work, you know.
I just don't feel the fire with De Niro. I haven't for a while.
No, I haven't either. No, even when he's been, you know, likable in something like Stardust, you know, in a little performance where he's sort of surprising and funny, you still don't feel that. I mean, certainly not on the level of Taxi Driver. Like, is there anything that screams? Is there anything that screams an actor who has a fire in his belly like Taxi Driver does? Like,
no.
Like, I mean, we're not even talking about that ballpark. Like, he's not even close. And I like De Niro, and I like stuff like Everybody's Fine. There's a cute little.
I liked him in Everybody's Fine. I thought he was very genuine in Everybody's Fine.
I did too, and that's what I'm saying. It's a cute little movie. But it's not something where you really feel that that this is his career and it's something that he enjoys doing. Like, it's not, you don't get that, like that, like we're saying about Pacino in the Kevorkian movie, that fire. Like, I know how to do this. This is how I'm going to do it. Another actor may do it his way, but I'm doing it this way. And, you know, I haven't gotten that from Pacino for a long time, but I have now with this movie. I wish we would get it from guys like De Niro. And Pacino, excuse me, not Pacino,
and
but
Hoffman,
again.
Hoffman is, and I know that you have a real affinity for Hoffman, and rightfully so, because when you look at actors in the 70s, Hoffman and beyond, but Hoffman turned in some of the most daring, ambitious performances out of all of them.
Yeah, and they're movies that are forgotten. Stuff like Papillon and Midnight Cowboy. The movies that are great, and we all recognize that they're great, but when you talk about the greatest movies of the 70s, sometimes they get missed. Sometimes they get forgotten.
Yeah.
And it's not as flashy as The Godfather or Taxi Driver. But Papillon is really, like, a performance that's out there, like, it's really, really
as you get older though, I mean, what kind of parts would offer the fire of a, or the ambition of a little big man or a taxi driver? I mean,
I don't know. The thing is, maybe you have to do what Pacino has sort of done the last 5 years or so and look to productions of Shakespeare, look to something like Merchant of Venice, which is as a movie nothing special. But it's him playing one of the greatest written parts of all time, like literally throughout the history of man. This is one of the parts that's written so well. You got to latch on to something like that. If they're not writing those sorts of parts in movies for you, you got to latch on to the classics like that. Or to, you know, a biopic like the Jack Kevorkian movie.
Right.
We've never really seen Robert De Niro do something like that. I mean, I don't. Nothing jumps to mind anyway. Like him doing
the last truly great performance of De Niro was, I think, Heat. I think he was great in Heat and This Boy's Life. It was like a 1-2 punch where, oh man, De Niro's back. That's why he's a great actor.
Yeah.
And then he disappeared again.
Yeah, I do think
yeah.
he's a little bit underrated in Men of Honor, and I think that's a movie that sort of flies under the radar because it feels like De Niro doing De Niro sometimes in that movie. But there's other scenes in that movie that are really, really strong.
The Nicholson's another one that I would love before he goes for him to get a nice juicy part again that offers more diversity and color than something like The Departed. I mean, that's a showy part.
Yeah.
But it's not a part of depth.
Interesting that you mention him, and absolutely, he's a guy that belongs in this exact same conversation with these other names. But I think the last chance he got for that kind of performance was probably About Schmidt. And unfortunately, it was a script that didn't really work that way.
Which is his version of, which De Niro's version of that is Everybody's Fine.
Right, right. It's a very, very, a lot of similarities between those two movies.
Yeah.
And About Schmidt seems like on paper, it's like, wow, Nicholson's going to play that part? He's going to play this old retired guy who's got nothing else left to live for? Nicholson, the playboy, you know, I mean, the guy who bangs a different 19-year-old every night of the week? But the movie doesn't work, you know, I mean, it's not funny. It's not truly very touching. It's just kind of, it's a little bit depressing and sad and slow, unfortunately. But
yeah.
He needs to sort of take another chance like that. I love him in The Departed, and I love him in Something's Gotta Give, playing Jack, basically. But I hope that he does take a couple more chances before he stops making movies.
He has an interesting impediment, too, that these other guys don't necessarily have. I think maybe Pacino comes closest in that Jack is, he's a personality force unto himself. I mean, he's...
Absolutely. He's a character.
You say...
Yeah.
He himself is a character that often overshadows the characters he plays. So it's... I think with the material the way it is, it's probably hard to find something that allows him to let go of those Jackisms, which was a real effort that he made on About Schmidt, and that's why it was an effective performance.
Yeah, effective performance, unfortunately, not an effective movie.
Yeah. Rick, I got you on the line. I want to bring you on before we close the show. Are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, bud.
Hey.
Say hi to Chris.
Hi, Chris. How you doing?
Hey, Rick. What's up, man?
Not much.
I want to bring you on because you're finishing your movie.
Yeah. Yeah, we finished shooting the last scene on Sunday, so we're just down to a lot of sound work and just like a couple small shots, and that's it.
Okay. So when, first of all, when are you going to let me see it? Seeing that I'm the, I'm the star of the first scene of it, I had to bring that up. And then when, you know, you're going to be a guest on the show talking about it, when others can see it, when is it going to be done?
Yeah. Well, we think we can have it done within the next, we're hoping within the next 2 months. So there's just a lot of sound work and, you know, like, you know, it's not our primary job, so we do it in our spare time. So I would guess in about 2 months it'll be, you know, ready to go. I mean, I would imagine you'll see it before we lock the picture, as they call it, because that way, you know, we can hear comments from you if we're still tweaking it.
Okay.
But I know you've seen a little bit of it.
Well, I've seen my scene. And honestly, that's all I really have to see. So I don't want to rush you. I've seen the most important part of it. Thank you. That's all I brought you on for, just to compliment my acting.
Oh, okay.
Chris, do you have anything to say about my acting? Okay. Okay, thank you. Have you seen any movies, Rick, in the past week or so?
Yes.
I didn't even think about it before I asked.
Yeah, I saw Eclipse. That was the last thing. I enjoyed it, you know, because I saw it with my daughter, so it was. We had a good time. It was memorable. And the movie's okay.
I hear it is okay, and I hear it's the best of the three so far.
Yeah, it is. We talked about it a little bit last week. You know, I liked it all right. David Slade did a good job.
I guess we only have one more of those things to do. Oh, no, they're making Breaking Dawn into two movies, so we got two more?
Yeah, two more. Yeah.
Oh, dear God.
I know.
And then we got two more Harry Potters.
Yep.
And then what? I guess the next big literary cinematic franchise is this Girl with the Dragon Tattoo thing.
Yep.
Yeah. The girl with the dragon tattoo, the girl who played with fire, the girl with the polo mallet, I think there's like a trilogy. The girl who likes to pierce things. Go ahead, Chris.
I just read that, actually. Yeah. It's a really good book, the first one.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
really
I know
good
people are astounded by the movie, the first movie. The second movie is already coming out now, but first movie just came out on DVD yesterday. So.
Yeah, well, that's the foreign version. They're actually already working on the American version as well, as I understand.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of which, Let the Right One In, the American version, Let Me In. Yeah. Have you seen that trailer?
Yeah. Looks a lot like the original.
Looks a lot like the original.
Well, here's an interesting quote. Somebody's talking about, the director of The Girl Who Played with Fire. Here's a quote from him.
The dragon tattoo?
Yeah. Well, The Girl Who Played with Fire is the sequel. I don't know if it's the same director as the first one. I don't know. But he says, I'm hoping the American remake will work out fine. And then he says, my brother made a film called Let the Right One In. That is also having a new version. That's how it is. Sweden is such a small country, we have to be happy for everything. So that's interesting that he's part of a franchise now, just like his brother. Well, it's not franchise, Let the Right One In, but it's inevitable. Yeah. I mean, but I hope it brings people to the original Let the Right One In.
Yeah, so do I.
I do. It won't. That's not how it is. I mean, the thing is, you know, like you said, like Rick said, it looks a lot like the original. It does. It looks a hell of a lot like the original. That's the idea. I mean, and it's unfortunate because it's kind of a double-edged sword. Like, the makers of this remake realized, like, that this was an awesome movie, and their whole thing was, man, I wish people would see it, but they won't because they're Americans and they're not going to watch a movie that's subtitled. So how can we get people interested in what was it? Their intentions are true, which is, this is a good story. We'd like to bring people to it, but they won't watch this version, so let's make a version that they will watch.
Yeah.
And it looks like they've been true to that. You know, I mean, it looks like they've been incredibly true to the source material, so you've got to commend them there. You've also got to sort of be groan that they have to do that in the first place, you know? Like, why can't people just go and rent this really awesome movie that looks exactly like this American version that you're making? So, I don't understand, but...
And the original movie's so great because it is so visual and inventively staged. I mean, it's not a movie of dialogue that you have to. It's not a movie you have to read. It's a movie you watch. I mean, and the staging of the climax alone is astounding. And I'm wondering if they're going to copy that verbatim, shot for shot, or if they're going to try to do their own version of something inventive like it. Because, I mean, that sequence wowed me, the sequence at the pool at the end.
I think that they will have to change that a little bit. That entire sequence was done in such a European film kind of way.
I agree.
You don't really see anything. You will never get a American version of a movie where you do not see the action happening like that. I just kind of find that very, very difficult to believe. Maybe the filmmaker would want to do it like that. The studio would never let them get away with it, you know.
There's a major reason why it was remade. Beyond it being a good movie, an international movie, that's all kind of irrelevant. I think the real reason why it was remade is because...
Vampires.
Vampires are hot right now. Well... Right. Are vampires going to go the way of 3D and kind of wear themselves out?
I don't think so. Like, the shit's been going on for 200 years or whatever. Wrote Dracula.
You know what? I tend to agree with Chris. Vampires, it's not a new thing. I mean, you know, Jamie, you know, Interview with the Vampire, that stuff's been around way before that even. It's been around a long time.
Yeah.
So it's undead. It's never dying.
Yeah.
Unfortunately not, and it's really fucking pathetic. Like, people, like, fucking obsessed with goddamn vampire movies. Like, the thing is, like, unfortunately, like, so many, it's really a genre all to itself. Like, we have comedy and drama and horror and vampire now. Like, it's a whole genre in and of itself. And just like every other genre, rarely is anything new brought to the table. But Let the Right One In was the exception to that. Like, as this genre goes, that was the exception. I can't think of a movie in the preceding 5 years or the, 5 years after that was as original in that genre as that particular movie. And, of course, instead of making another original one, they're going to try and, you know, do another lap on the same idea. It's not going to work, you know. I don't think that that's going to work. Just looking at that preview, if there were no original Let the Right One In, and this was a vampire movie that was coming out, was 100% original called Let Me In, does that look like something that would work? It's sort of a slow burn type, plotting movie. Like, does that look like something that American audiences will buy?
As much as any other horror movie, I would imagine.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, the movie doesn't offer those kinds of scares. Like, it doesn't... unless they've changed it quite a bit.
No, you're right. You're right. It is like The Hunger. It is a movie of atmosphere more than shocks and thrills.
Right. And it's about who this character lets close to her, which, by the way, brings up an interesting question. On the Internet, there was a book that this Let the Right One In was based on. But my perception of the original movie was that her caretaker, the older gentleman who went out and got blood for her, was not a pedophile, but was at one time a child just like Oscar, who she fell in love with and let in, so to speak, who took care of her for years to come. But on the Internet, there seems to be some thought that he was a pedophile, which I thought...
I think they've made him a pedophile for this remake.
Is that right?
Yeah. I think they've really made it explicit.
Well, that's unfortunate because I don't think that that was the. Well, that certainly
wasn't my perception of the original movie. That he was a pedophile.
Yeah, I agree. If a movie like Love at First Bite does not kill the vampire genre, I don't think anything will. All right, I think we've lost Chris. So. I guess we're going to end the show. I think okay. His cell phone just went out.